Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
My name is Chris Rawlings. I'm the director of the British Council here in Colombia. It's fabulous to be once again here in Cartagena. The British Council is, I'm delighted to say, a global partner of the Hay Festival, and we work in partnership with the Hay Festival across the world in all of the international editions. The festival originated in Hay on Wye. As well as that, though, we're this year partnering with Granta. And Granta publishes the best of British novelists. And I'm delighted to be able to say that this evening we've got two of those with us, and they will be talking shortly. I'm not going to say too much, just a short word of introduction, and we'll get straight into it. So we have Nadifa Mohamed, born 1981 in Hargeisa, Somalia, moved to London with her family in 1986 for what was supposed to be a short stay, but after civil war broke out in her home country, decided to stay in the UK. Nadifa studied at Oxford, history and politics, and her first novel, Black Mamba Boy, based on her father's life, was shortlisted for the John Llewellyn Rees Prize in the Guardian First Book Award, and she currently lives in London, in South London, I think. And Sanjeev Sanota. Oh, hello, hello, yep. Born in 1991 as well, in Derby, moved to Chesterfield, centre of the universe, when he was still a boy. And his paternal grandparents had emigrated to Britain from the Punjab in 1966. He studied mathematics and was working in marketing when he began writing his first novel, the widely acclaimed Ours Are the Streets, a story written from the point of view of a young British Pakistani man who decides to become a suicide bomber. Sanjeev now lives in Leeds with his wife, and I can attest, beautiful daughter, and he's currently working on his second novel. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to leave you in the very capable hands of full journalist and correspondent, Razia Iqbal. Over to you. Thank you very much.
Chris, thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming, everyone. Great to see so many people here. It's my huge pleasure to talk to both Nadifa Mohamed and Sanjeev Sahota. Their books are quite different in many ways, and I'm going to assume that even if you've read them, I'll do a little bit of explaining as we go along. The format of the event is, it's basically an hour long. I will ask questions of the two of them for about 35 to 40 minutes, giving people in the audience the chance to ask questions that I have completely failed to ask, and possibly more interesting questions. And if you are too shy to come forward, I'll carry on asking them questions until you find your voices. So I'm going to start by just saying a little bit about where I think their writing overlaps. I was really struck by reading in the Green Room a quote from Nadifa, where she says how small lives are affected by big events is what she's interested in. And in many ways, both of their novels, and I'm going to focus on Nadifa's second novel and Sanjeev's first one, could be said to be that, really. Ordinary lives being affected by much bigger political turmoil. Nadifa, I want to start by asking you about your book, The Orchard of Lost Souls, because there's at the heart of it is the dictatorship in Somalia. Yes. It's set in 1987, 1988. And what really, really struck me is that your willingness and your desire to give voice to three very ordinary women, because the story takes place at the end of the 1980s when the lives of those three women collide, but they are three very different women. There's a 9-year-old refugee, there's a solitary widow, and there is a female soldier. Why was it important for you to to first of all choose women as protagonists, because your first book was very much about your father's journey and dealt with a very male perspective.
Absolutely. I was only really able to touch on female Somali... Is that better? Okay. I was only really able to touch very briefly on the lives of women in my first book. So the minute I knew I was going to write about the Civil War, I wanted it to be from a female perspective. The situation for women in Somalia in the 1980s was particularly interesting because the men were so deeply harassed by the government that women ended up taking a lot of their roles as the breadwinners in their families, as supporters of the rebel movement. So I found that very interesting. And the kernel of the second book, The Orchard of Lost Souls, is actually my grandmother's story, what happened to her in the 1980s when we left, and she was left paralyzed as the war began.
And so the character that resembles most closely your grandmother is the woman in her 50s.
Yes, Khalsa.
Khalsa, who has... she stands up for the 9-year-old child who's being beaten up.
Yes.
And she is then abused and is violently attacked inside a prison. That you don't really flinch at all from the violence that women in particular face, and also the violence that women are willing to wreak on other women, in the case of the female soldier,
yeah.
Filsan. I mean, that was particularly brutal. Why did you want to show that?
I think maybe violence is often understood as a male problem, but that's not the case. If it was, I think it'd be much easier to fix. In Somalia, there are so many different layers of violence, a mother to her children, a husband to his wife, the government to the civilians, the police to the people beneath them, that it's really hard to unpick where this violence is actually coming from, because it's at every level. The children attack homeless people. So I wanted to investigate further that violence.
And when you talk about violence in the context of the mother to their children, I'm assuming that one of the specific things that you're referring to is female circumcision, or as we like to describe it now, as female genital mutilation.
Yes.
And that does happen. And in the book, there's an exploration of what it means to the prostitutes to whom it's happened, and also the 9-year-old girl has a revelation that this may well happen to her.
I wasn't actually thinking of that kind of violence, even though that is discussed in the book. It was actually much more extreme everyday violence. Children being locked up in their homes, people chaining their children, flogging their children. It got to the point where basically, as long as you didn't kill or maim your child, you could pretty much do anything to them. And it became a release valve, I think, for mothers in particular, under stress, to take it out on their children.
When you say under stress, given that the context in which this is happening is the fear engendered by a dictatorship and living under authoritarian rule, is that what you want the reader to understand? The way in which a kind of state-sponsored violence can filter down into the lives of ordinary people?
Absolutely, but I think it's also the reverse. How much of the violence that became endemic in Somali culture or society found a kind of blooming in the dictatorship? There's one man who was very elderly in the 1980s. You know, he was almost killed in a car crash. So it wasn't just him. I think he became quite a remote figure. It was all of the small acts of violence that made the country so difficult to be in, and was one of the reasons we had to leave.
And you left when you were 4. And how much of what you have researched for the novel comes from your family's direct conversations, a kind of oral history, if you like, and how much has been actively researched by you?
This one was a lot more actually built up within my imagination, but I did do interviews with my mother, my aunts, my cousins, and also within kind of the Somali diaspora in London. So they formed the you know, all the building blocks of the book that I built up into The Orchard of Lost Souls. But it was more a case of me finding the psychology of the characters interesting, and they drifted further and further away from the people that I actually know.
Were they willing to speak to you openly about things that were clearly painful, I would have thought?
Yes, I think particularly for women as well, there is a sense that they've never found that their stories were worth telling. My mother kept saying that I was just a housewife, I didn't see anything, I didn't do anything, I've got nothing to tell you. But at the same time, she was there when the Somali flag was raised for the first time in the 60s. She experienced every change in Somali society very directly. So she's a perfect witness.
And there are lovely moments in the novel where the acknowledgement of pride in a newly independent Somalia, you know, having your own airline, for example, yeah. And yet it flips very quickly to exposing the brutality that was there for very ordinary people. I want to carry on talking about how you used your imagination in the context of very real events some more. But let me just turn to Sanjeev now, because you have to do that quite a lot in your book, because for a first novel, you know, a lot of people would argue that they tend to be quite autobiographical, or at least there are, you know, references to one's own life. And as far as I'm aware, you're not a Muslim. You have no intention of becoming a suicide bomber. So in that respect, pretty much all of your first book, Hours of the Streets, is an imagined world, but one that is informed clearly by the culture around us and the politics around us. And so I suppose I'd like to start by asking you, what was the germ for you? Why did you want to understand or get inside the head of a young British Pakistani man who is so disaffected that he's prepared to kill himself and many other people?
That's a tough one. It's always hard to answer where ideas come from, but from a purely factual point of view, it's true that... Can everyone hear me okay?
Just a touch.
Is that better? Yeah. It's true that I was living in Leeds at the time of the London bombings in July 2005, and the...
2007.
No, was it?
7-7, I think that's why they call it 7-7.
That's because it's the 7th of July.
That's right, 2005, you're right, you're right. Okay. 2005.
In the 2000s, there was an attack on London. And I was living in Leeds at that time when the guy that got called the ringleader of those attacks was Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, who lived in Beeston in Leeds, about a mile away from where I was living, though I didn't know the guy. So that's true, and so maybe that sparked something inside me. But I think there were questions of because in some respects you're right. I'm not a Muslim. I've never been to Pakistan or Kashmir or to Afghanistan. So in some respects we're very different, and yet there are things that I think overlapped between us. We're both the child of the child of immigrants. We're both brought up in the north of England. We're both of a similar age. We were brought up in the north of England at a time when it was perhaps quite a difficult place to be different. And I think that sense of cultural duality and being not really feeling like you're fitting in that late adolescent, early 20s sort of period were things that I think I could sort of see in him and also see in myself at that point. So I think that provided the germ of an idea, as it were.
The duality that you speak of is key to understanding Imtiaz, the character. And the entire novel is written in his voice. I mean, he engages with his English wife, and so we get a sense of her life, and she clearly comes from a fairly solid working class family, and so you get some sense of her relationship with her mother. But on the whole, it is very much to do with him feeling ill at ease or not entirely comfortable with living in British society. But that doesn't really come out until he goes back to Pakistan. So the cauldron of politics that Pakistan is only starts to make an impact on him when he goes back for his father's funeral. And I... I wondered why you felt that was, because for a lot of young people, they don't have to go back to their country of origin to feel disaffected, and yet that was completely the turning point for him.
It was one thing that I noticed when I was reading around the subject of why do young men in Britain feel a sort of sympathy for Muslims that are acting, that are suicide bombers, or some young men, a very tiny proportion of young men. One thing that came out to me was that they do feel a sense of humiliation in themselves, that they're not able to protect their brothers as they saw them, that are being attacked in Palestine or Iraq or Somalia or Turkey or Bosnia. And I thought, well, why would they feel a sense of need? Why would they feel a need to protect these people that they've never met, that they have no obvious connection with other than a shared religion? And I suppose that sent me down the route thinking about maybe it is to do with ideas of not feeling that you have a sense of identity and that you don't feel you belong in the country where you are brought up, where you have perhaps even got married. And that search for an identity, I think, takes him to Pakistan. Well, no, his father's death takes him to Pakistan, but a search for who he is as a man sort of links him with the land and with the people. For the first time, he feels a sense of belonging. He says, you know, for the first time, I felt like I had a real past with real people who'd lived real lives. And that's very important to him, that sense that he does have a history and a heritage.
I love the moment when he feels he utterly belongs and has a past and has a family. When one of his, either his cousins or one of his friends, says to him, you know, you don't have to thank us all the time. Mm. It's a kind of complete given that you will be embraced and that you will be welcomed, and there's just an assumption that you don't have to, there's no formality. And that felt like it was I am Pakistani, and I really related to that, even though I feel, you know, utterly deracinated having grown up most of my life in Britain. But I did relate to that. I felt that was very warm, because it made him feel that he didn't have to explain himself anymore.
Yeah. It's a very deeply held need for a lot of people to feel a sense of home and feel a sense of somewhere where you can say, yeah, that is where I belong. That will always be my place. But I think perhaps it's even more acutely so in, you know, because these suicide bombers, they tend to be, in nearly every case, young men and adolescents. You know, there's no geriatric suicide bombers. It is people, and I think when you are an adolescent, you're in that time in your life, you are searching for meaning, you are quite open to different ways of thinking about the world, and you're kind of just grasping for something to hold on to. And that sense of adventure, searching for a sense of excitement, all plays into that. And they go on this trip to Kashmir and Afghanistan, and he just ends up down a path that he doesn't feel he can turn away from.
When you first started thinking about wanting to write this particular story, was it clear in your mind that you wanted to explore being inside the suicide bomber's head, to trace his journey? Because you could have written that story in many, many different ways. And did you try before you alighted on that particular format, which is pretty much a diary that he is leaving to his wife and his child?
You're right. The book's it's presented as the written account of him writing to his wife, his daughter. He addresses his father, who is dead, his mother, anyone who will listen. Sometimes there's this character, yeah, anyone who will listen. He's just searching for someone that will listen to him and actually and understand him. No, the book went through several different formats, from written in third person with a larger cast of characters, to a sort of which didn't work, to a stream of consciousness. It's like I was sat there trying to channel William Faulkner, but that didn't work either. It was, but in the end, I ended up deciding that it had to be written in the first person. And when you're writing when I was writing the first person, and you've got a narrator who may or may not be around at the end, the diary format felt the most natural choice.
This idea of writing about people who may perceive themselves to be on the margins of society and giving them a voice with a view to having them understood in some way, it seems to me that you both do that. And I wondered, Nadifa, if you could say something about this duality, because you moved to Britain from Somalia when you were four, and yet both of your books are an attempt to chronicle how you perceive Somali history to be from the perspective of somebody who was born in the early 1980s. So what is that in you as a writer that makes you feel this, that needs to be chronicled?
It's a difficult question to answer. The first book about my father's early life, it compelled me to write it. So I wouldn't have said that I was going to chronicle Somali history. I really just wanted to record my father's really extraordinary life. And then the second one, that felt more personal in a way, because I was writing about a world that I didn't know, that I was part of for my earliest childhood. So I was returning to somewhere that in my mind maybe I had never fully left. And as Chris said in the introduction, I thought we would return. I thought that the trip to Britain was a short thing and it ended up lasting until now. So I wanted to return to that neighborhood. I wanted to return to the women that I loved and lost and tell their stories, because again, it feels as if, not maybe that no one's going to do it, but we'll have to wait a long time for people to do it.
Well, certainly Somalia has been chronicled in fiction, you know, most notably by Nuruddin Farah. And there is a, in a way you could argue that you're the next generation of writers who didn't live through the horror, but your perception of it is
kind of
informed
by it.
Yeah,
that's true. But I think also there's different layers. So I'm writing about northern Somalia, which is now an unrecognized republic called Somaliland. So it's doubly marginalized. It's Somalia, but it's not Somalia. And it's somewhere where the stories are even less heard than they are from, just say, Mogadishu. And very few writers are actually writing about Somaliland.
The figure of the female soldier was, for me, the most compelling in the novel, because she seemed so utterly brutalized by the role that she found herself in as a female soldier. But her relationship with her father seemed to be key to what made her tick. Her father was a senior figure in the army, and that he spared her certain
some
aspects. He spared her some terrible things, in that she wasn't circumcised, she joined the army. And yet her relationship with him is the one that, in a way, reveals probably the most about the complexity of what it means to be a young woman navigating your place in the world.
Absolutely. She's much more privileged than the other two characters. You know, she's a child of the revolution, dictatorship, and she can actually gain a lot from it. And she's an idealist, and I think Sanjeev is also writing about these people who are idealists and whose wishes for a better world are twisted into something very sinister. So she has a dysfunctional relationship with her father, in the sense that he took her from her mother as part of the divorce, and she becomes a kind of toy for him, someone to mold, to turn into a new kind of woman. And she is a new kind of woman, but there's no place for her outside of her family's home, really, of her father's home.
Sanjeev, given that you're in ethnic terms, I guess, removed from the character that you've written about, because you didn't grow up in a Muslim family, I wonder whether you felt that there was something about writing his story that felt journalistically important as well as imaginatively important.
In terms of there needing, well, I suppose it's true to say that we, if there is a debate on this subject, it's probably not a very intelligent one. It tends to be polarized in terms of either these young men are completely crazy and mad and it's all irrational. And
evil is the word that is often used,
And there's just no point trying to understand them. Or it's the other side, and it's completely irrational, and it's all to do with foreign policy, and if only there was a caliphate and Palestine was sorted out, all of this would go away. And though neither of those seem particularly satisfactory or convincing to me, so maybe I think I maybe thought that the novel, that if there is an answer, it's perhaps in that grey middle area, and the novel is always a good form to try to get inside the skin of people.
So tell me why. So why does a novel allow you to play with that much more, that steps outside of the world that I'm much more familiar with, which is, it's this. This is factually the case. This is what we understand.
Because I don't think you can always believe what people tell you and what these young, the videos that these young men leave behind. If that is the truth of it, then I can't believe that that is the reasons why. That is the real reason why they go down there, that it is all to do with hatred for the West and so forth. I think there's the forces are much more internal, the psychological forces are much more deeply set, and they're to do with questions of identity and home and belonging and those sorts of notions. I think the external factors like, you know, geopolitical concerns and, you know, racism all play their part, but they all, I think, almost act as triggers for something that is already inside them.
Because he is, Imtiaz is very torn, isn't he? Because he has a child, he's done something fairly transgressive in his own family in that he's married an English girl and his parents have resigned themselves to it, but that's difficult. It's tricky territory when you come from a very orthodox way of thinking, but also if you have chosen to ghettoize yourself in a country where you feel like you're in a minority, to then stand outside of that minority and say, well, actually, I'm in love with this English girl. He's made a big step. And what I found really intriguing in his account of trying to understand himself, because the book isn't just about us being able to understand the mind of a suicide bomber. No. It's about him trying to understand himself. He really loves Rebecca. He loves his child. So he has, you know, he's created roots in the United Kingdom, but the pull of belonging in a more visceral way is so strong for him.
And he ends up just pushing Rebecca away and just not... Because they do reach out to him. They do say, well, I can see you're having nightmares. You're losing weight. What's the matter? Talk to me. And he keeps on pushing them away as if he just doesn't want to let them in. And there is something very... You're right, the pull of the need to belong and feel at home just overwhelms anything else for him.
I wonder whether, because your next novel, which is, I'm assuming, not finished yet, but there was an extract of it
It's nearly finished.
It's nearly finished.
2 or 3 days, hopefully.
Yeah. Fantastic. You heard it here first. It's about the lives of immigrants, illegal immigrants in the United Kingdom, the kind of invisibility of their lives. And I use that word on purpose because immigration as a political subject is a huge, you know, it's a hot potato. It's possibly the one subject and issue which is going to inform certainly the next general election in the United Kingdom, but it's a big issue in European countries generally, and it's a big issue in America too. And I wondered why you're drawn to what appear to be the big issues, but wanting to try and get some sense of what they feel like at a very sometimes prosaic and very ordinary level.
You know, I really don't see myself as a topical writer, but everyone just think I'm lying, you know, but I think it's just a certain sense that the things I'm very interested in the world around me. I write about the things I see walking around in my streets at home, and I think it just so happened that some of the big issues at the moment in England coincide with things that interest me or I've got some knowledge about, whether it's cultural duality, or the lives of illegal immigrants that arrive from India to come and stay in the UK. You know, I think a lot of people in the Indian community know these people, know of them and know the lives they are living. So that's, I think, the main pull. But there is also, I think it connects in with what we spoke earlier about marginalised lives, and I think I think the novel just allows me to dignify hidden lives, and I think that's probably the reason why I read in the first place, to dignify lives that are otherwise hidden from us.
Interesting you talk about the lives that are hidden from us, because for a lot of people when the July 7th bombings happened, that image of the four young men with their backpacks on getting on the train from Luton into central London just felt as though they were, you know, they could have been anybody. They could have been people you and I know. And of course, they are people you and I know. And I think that the separation that we do all the time, particularly in news and current affairs, journalistically, we're constantly saying, well, those are those people. They do those bad things. But what fiction allows you to do is say they're of us.
They are us. They're a part of the society we create. And when you look at some of the accounts of that their neighbours were saying about these young men, they're saying he was a really nice boy. He went to the shops for me only last week because I couldn't get there. And you know, and all these things happen. And it doesn't seem to make sense to call them mad or irrational or evil. And you're right. And the novel is just a vehicle, is a brilliant vehicle for getting inside their heads and showing them as something that, in a sense, we've created.
I want to ask you both about your lives as writers, because I was really struck by reading that you actually didn't start reading novels in any sort of serious way until you were 18. So why didn't you read before? And what did you read then that made you think, this is a door for me that's opened?
That's fine. This is going to follow me forever now.
It is. You really, seriously, don't say those sorts of things.
I think my school was just going through a change in curriculi, and I think novels just fell through the gap for me, and I missed out on that particular stream. Though we did plays and poetry and fragments of novels in anthologies, I think the novel just sort of passed me by. But you're right, I was 18. I was catching a plane to India in the summer before university, and I picked up Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, which was, I don't know why, well, probably because I was going to India and it was Midnight's Children. Maybe I noticed it was published in the year I was born, but and that just started a love of reading.
How about you, Nadifa? Did you think that, I mean, you studied politics at university, did you want to always write fiction? Was there
not at all? Not at all. I studied history and politics, and I was interested in the political side, and I thought maybe I could find a job that would allow me to pursue that interest. But I worked for a film company after university, and that's where I started writing creatively, and I took it from there.
And how easy is it for you to think about the sorts of subjects you want to write about from now on? Do you feel that you're always going to be drawn to writing about Somalia, or at least be informed by Somalia as a backdrop?
No, I don't think so. I think, I know that my next book will largely be set in London. It will have Somali characters, but London will be the real character, I think. And from then on, I don't feel a particular need to write stories set in Somalia or about Somalis, but so far, the stories that have got under my skin have been about Somalis.
This idea that Sanjeev was talking about, the duality of identity, is that something that you have always been aware of yourself as someone who's grown up in London, but obviously have a very, very strong connection to Somalia?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very hard to navigate. It was hard for me, and I think actually my first book was a way of trying to make sense of who I was and where I was and why I was there. So it's not something that I think is ever going to be fixed. The older I get, the more I feel as if that I feel that London is where I belong and is my home and is where I feel most relaxed. But when things happen that kind of show the schisms in British society, then I do step back and think, oh, you know, do I really have a place here?
Like when? Give us an example of when that might have happened.
Probably most recently, after the court case over Mark Duggan's death, and it revealed real kind of hostility between different communities. And some of the comments you read on the internet and things like that, they could have been from 70 years ago, 80 years ago, and it
feels... So for those who don't know, this was a young black man who was shot dead by the police, and the verdict, I think it was an independent review, said that it was a lawful killing, and the
even though he was unarmed.
Yeah, he was unarmed, and initially, in the immediate aftermath of his death, there were the most serious riots took place, not just in London, but all over the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. So working with young Somalis as a mentor and things like that, I can see how problems that I had in the 1980s, they're still facing. And there are improvements, there's no doubt about that, but it's very slow.
Sanjeev, we've touched on it so often, the navigating of identity and feeling at home or not. In many ways, you could argue that it not being something that's fixable, that it isn't a solution, there isn't a solution for individuals, actually does give rise to very fertile territory for writers, doesn't
it? It's a great subject, yeah, and you're right, I think there's no point looking for... I think this is kind of Imam Diaz's tragedy. He sort of confuses a sense of belonging with just the everyday difficulty that everyone has of just getting through that period in your life when you are just looking for meaning. And I think if he'd have given himself a few more years, he'd have just got through it and just opened up to, you know, everything the world has to offer. And you realize that there is no sense of home for a lot of people, or there's just many different homes, you know, and they don't have to be geographical. They can be internal or with people or with, you know, there's many different forms. So it's not fixable. It's just, but you can learn to appreciate that it's not fixable as well.
I wondered if you had read other writers who had written about suicide bombers in the immediate aftermath of both 9/11 and the Madrid bombings, as well as 7/7. Sebastian Foakes has tried, Salman Rushdie has, Martin Amis, John Updike. I mean, you know, had you read any of their books?
I'd read The Updike Terrorist, which I liked. It, you know, Updike's a writer of just enormous stature, and he's great to read. I'm not sure I was... it's my favourite of his books, but it gave me a lot to think about, definitely.
Okay, I've got more questions, but I'm going to open it to the floor. So we're going to put our headphones on in case there are people who are going to ask the questions in Spanish so that we can understand them. I'm speaking just for myself, of course, because I don't speak Spanish. So raise your hand, and I don't know if there is a microphone anywhere. Yes, no? Yes, I think there might be. The lady right in the front. Thank you for putting your hand up straight away. Just wait for the microphone.
Sí, gracias. Una pregunta para Sanjeev. Sobre tu libro del terrorista suicida. Sí, al mostrar la parte humana, la cara humana de ese terrorista, no queda la sensación de cambiar un poco la percepción que se tenga sobre estas personas, en vez de ser unos locos suicidas, sí, ya lo estaríamos como justificando la con la parte humana ya de esa persona. Gracias.
So the question, I only turned on my machine right at the last minute, but I think the question was, if you are giving them a voice and they're trying, it's being explained why they conduct suicide bombings, aren't you, in a way, justifying their actions?
Yeah, and in danger of sympathising, I think. I don't think understanding breeds sympathy necessarily. I don't think it does. I think it's important to try to understand. If you want to have any chance of stopping these things from happening, I think it's important to get down to, you know, the root cause of why these young men are going down that route and why they feel the need to. What is it that drives them on? And I think trying to understand them is the only way forward. Otherwise, we just think they're mad, and it's the easy solution to call them mad and to just wash our hands of it. I think the harder thing is to try to actually put a human face on it and try to understand what are the human forces that are sparking off inside them. And I think it can be scary to do that, in to read a novel that does, where you do find yourself starting to have sympathy with someone who is bent on killing lots of people. But I think that's one of the things a novel... It's one of the more important things I think a novel can do, is to make you try to understand other people. I think that's why a lot of people, it's one of the reasons why I read, is to see the world through the eyes of others, even if those others aren't people I like. One of my favourite books is Crime and Punishment with Raskolnikov, and who's horrible, who's morally just repugnant, but yet I feel I understand him, and I feel better for doing so.
And it's certainly true to say that Imtiaz is terrified at the prospect of killing himself. He may not reveal how scared or morally wrong it might be to kill lots of innocent people, but he is actually very frightened.
He's frightened of taking those last few steps, especially when he sees his friend go through it. He witnesses that, and there's no glory in it. He just sees the ugly aftermath and the brutal reality of it. So you're right that there's, and I think we identify with that fear in him as well.
More questions. The microphone's at the back, and then we'll come to you in the front.
This is a question for both authors, but perhaps particularly for Nafida, given that she's talking about Somalia. Given that we're here in Cartagena, I'm curious to have you two define what audience or readership was in your mind when you were writing the novels. And in particular, since I'm embarrassed to say I know almost nothing about Somalian history, I'm just curious as to whether, Nafida, you thought that anybody reading your book should know something about Somalian history before he or she reads it, or whether it's a blank slate and you're happy to have any reader around the world read your book.
Okay, so the question was, you couldn't hear the question. He was talking about the readership, whether you had a particular readership in mind, and he doesn't know very much about Somali history, so are you expecting people to know already a little bit about it? What's the intention in terms of your, or what your expectation is in terms of the readership?
Okay, no, I don't have a particular readership in mind. I think if I'm writing to satisfy myself, and I'm looking for the things that I would want to find in the novel. I have to be conscious of the fact that I do have a strong Somali readership who know a lot about the state of Somalia, the history of Somalia, and it's a very, lots of things are contested. But I wouldn't say that you have to have a knowledge of Somali history to read either book. They're following the lives of individuals, and enough is explained just from their perspective that I think that's kind of enough.
Yeah, I think definitely enough is explained. When you talk about a history that is contested, among the readership who do know Somali history, and Somalis in particular, do you get specific responses arguing with you about how you've presented it?
Well, no, I think there's general agreement. I haven't had any kind of very hostile reactions to the book, even though I knew that was a possibility. People don't tend to talk about the war openly. It's something that's talked about anonymously on the internet a lot of the time. So it's very unusual to actually uncover the experiences that people had during the war. Just speaking to my cousin, I found out that she'd stayed in the same dress for nearly a year because she'd fled. And that was that. She didn't have any access to her belongings. And she was 10 years old living in a refugee camp. So there's a lot of uncovered ground and a lot of trauma and a lot of secrecy. So that's, I think, what came out to me when I have been doing events with Somalis.
More questions. So can we have the microphone here next, please? So the question at the back there. No, just where you are already.
Hello.
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I have a question for you, too. I think, that post-colonial question about who you are, at the same time you write in English, you live in England. And what I'm thinking right now in Edward Said and Orientalism, and I would like to ask about that post-colonial question for you, who you are, how you feel with your back country, with your Somalia or Pakistan.
From Pakistan.
I'm sorry.
I'm not entirely clear what your question is.
Well, at the same time, you are writers living in England and born British, but you have roots in other countries, in past colonies, and I think it's really interesting
I'm interested in it too. I'm interested in how that relationship plays out. So my father had a very brutal experience of empire. And one of the reasons we're in England is because of that relationship to empire. And when I think about modern conflicts such as Islamic fundamentalism, whatever we want to call it, I think it's part and parcel of that history. I think that it's a reaction to the powerlessness that was left behind within colonized countries. So it's still a living history. It's still something where the French and British and other empires took a lot and gained a lot and left a dearth behind. And there's a lot of anger because of that.
Do you want to say something about that? You don't have
to. No, I agree. I think that it's going to take a very long time for it all to play out. And India in particular had such a unique relationship with Britain. You know, the crown in the empire, whatever it was, but it seems
the jewel in the crown,
and there's in that sense that's not gone away from India. It's still but there are definite Anglo overtones running throughout that country, whether it's the judicial system or the railway network. It's still quite there are still very deeply Anglo roots in that country, and it does play out in very strange ways throughout the country in terms of people, that love-hate relationship, and that's, I think England has that with a lot of countries that it has colonised in the past.
So the lady at the back.
Hello, for Nadita. Many people who escape civil war situations, for example, escape the Bosnian War, they describe a feeling of escapee or survivor guilt. And I was just wondering whether you or anyone you knew had experienced that sort of thing, and if you had, whether that was an impetus in your investigation or your fascination with a trauma that you hadn't known firsthand.
Yes, I think there's a huge element of that in many people. I witnessed, if you can call it witnessing, the war through the letters and cassettes that my family in they were in Ethiopian refugee camps, were sending us. So you get a very small snapshot of lives, and they normally are sent when someone has died. So all of these bulletins bring bad news. When I speak to other people, there's normally one incident at least from that period that they are struggling to get over. One of the similar situations or cases was a family who had an elderly relative who couldn't move from her bed, and when everyone fled for their lives, she died. You know, she starved to death, and the family has never really recovered from that. There's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame, and there are many other cases of that, of someone who hasn't been able to help or someone who has actually contributed to someone else's death. And we haven't had a truth and reconciliation process at all. So many of the perpetrators and their victims are living side by side in the diaspora. So I'm fascinated by that. In terms of whether I have any kind of survivor's guilt, I think I feel a responsibility to people. I'm very aware of the opportunities that I've had in comparison to my cousins, who are just as talented or anything as I am. So I do want to engage in, you know, contribute something to this country that I was born in and have a connection to. But also, as I think many Somalis in the diaspora are also getting tired of that sense of responsibility. You can be supporting a whole family in the UK and supporting another 20 people or 30 people in Somaliland, and we just can't manage that anymore.
Interesting. Any more hands going up? Yes, several. So one there and one there.
I think this question could apply to both of them, but I'm just going to, Sanjeev, if you don't mind. I can imagine, say, a couple of years before you wrote the book, you go down to the local pub and you tell a few mates, you graduated mathematics, you're going to write a book about a suicide bomber. They're probably going to think you are a little mad or a nice sense of humor. and particularly not being British born, so, you know, not being a Gora, sort of thing, if that means anything to you. What sort of obstacles, I'm sure you have plenty of obstacles when it came to publishing and being successful with the book, what would you say was the toughest one and how do you overcome it?
So for those who don't know the word Gora, it's Hindi for white person.
Yeah. So the question was, what's my toughest obstacle to being published? Is that right?
Did I get that correct.
Right? Yeah.
To being published, yeah.
Presumably you're asking that question because he's not white.
That's one. A, because of that, and B, because of the topic.
Right.
Yeah. No, I didn't find the topic held me back, or people were... I didn't get the sense that people were afraid to publish a book on the subject. I think there's... In England, there was a lot of questioning around wanting writers to engage with the subject, or wanting people, novels, to try and step into the space or the vacuum that was created when people were trying to look for answers. So I didn't have any difficulties in getting published. My publication process was, I was very fortunate, it was quite straightforward. I don't think not being a Muslim held me back in writing about it. Inevitably, it meant I got things wrong. I did an event in Leicester, I remember, and a woman who was in full niqab stood up and said, "I loved your book, but you know, a Muslim wouldn't do this. He wouldn't touch someone's feet. You wouldn't find that make of car in Pakistan. This wouldn't happen. That wouldn't happen." And you kind of think, "Okay, hands up. I got that wrong." But I think that's sort of inevitable when you are making, you know, a cultural leap, especially into someone else's backyard. I'm not a Muslim. I'm never going to know that world as deeply as someone who's been brought up in that world does. But I think that's okay. I think the positives to be gained when you do make that jump into someone else's backyard far outweigh, it's worth taking the risk that you might get a few facts wrong. So that didn't bother me either. And it's the same with my second book. I'm not an illegal immigrant, but I think that's all to the good.
Did you ever get any negative reactions from Muslims in terms of the perspective that you chose and the fact that you chose to be inside a suicide bomber's head?
There were a few people who objected to me writing about the book as I'm not a Muslim, which I don't agree with, because I think, you know, that's why we sort of read. And there were some people who said I was just engaging in the cultural psychology of trying to overanalyze a Muslim bomber, that actually the reasons are much more politically driven than my novel engages in, but that may be for suicide bombers. I'm sure actually there's as many different reasons for people wanting to blow themselves up as there are suicide bombers, but I didn't feel that was totally valid either. I think we put too much emphasis. I think absolutely the geopolitical concerns play a significant part, but I think that if that was the only reason, then I think there'd be a lot more suicide bombers than there were, because lots of people are annoyed and peed off with, you know, foreign policy, but only a few go on to actually blow themselves up. And I think for Imtiaz, he sees it as almost an act of love as much as an act of terror.
There was another hand there.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you both how you guys came up with the story and how you guys built up the story, because I see you both took a context, a very specific context and a very special situation, but the situations are like, as I said, very specific, but a novel is something very long, you know, and it takes a story. So what was the process of building up those stories?
For me, the process is quite complicated. I have a bad habit of not structuring my books before I start. I normally have just one image or one scene in mind, and I feel as if I can make a whole novel from it. And so far it's worked, but I don't want to try that again. So I had my grandmother's story as a basis for my second novel. And then lots of stopping and starting. I had to get rid of quite a few pages before I really found what I was trying to say. And it was by actually ignoring a lot of the political context of that time. I found that quite distracting and quite confusing. So I just zoned in on these three characters who are both all three are isolated. All three are struggling to find a role for themselves as women in Somali society. So once that kind of became clearer to me, then I could enjoy spending time with them and actually just say Kausa, the elderly character. It was really remarkable for me to think back to the things that she had seen. If she had traveled the country in the 60s and 70s, she'd find, you know, a place that no one really would know about now. Mogadishu was this kind of swinging city with women in miniskirts and, you know, people riding Vespers, and it was a really dynamic place, and it's gone. And one of the things that comes out clearly when you look at the Somali presence online, just say, is a real nostalgia for that world. Children who are too young to have ever have known it look at these videos of Mogadishu just with traffic lights. You know, the fact that Mogadishu had traffic lights and traffic police and cinemas and things like that, that's what I was excited about as well, this world that has gone now.
It's been different with both books. The first book is a character study for all intents and purposes, and so the story grew out of just organically building up his character step by step. So I didn't start off thinking, what is a suicide bomber? How does a suicide bomber think? What does a suicide bomber, you know, do on a daily basis? I just started off by thinking of, here's a young man growing up in the north of England, you know, what's he like? Who does he love? What makes him laugh? What makes him cry? What does he think about at night? What's his relationship like with his parents? All those just those sort of novelistic, well, I think of them as just novelistic questions that would enable me to get a grip on the man. I then slowly take him on that journey and then see where it goes. So that wasn't planned. The first novel wasn't planned in at all, and I had to stop and start again several times before I got to the end of a first draft. It was a long process. With the second novel, it's a much it's not a character study as such. It doesn't centre around, you know, you're not just inside one person's head. It's written in the third person. It's a much bigger book with a larger cast of characters and takes place over more continents and over greater time frame. And so I planned that out in a lot more detail at the beginning, just to make sure I could marshal these characters through the story in some sort of dignified fashion. And it's good. It's taken roughly the same amount of time as the first one, so maybe it doesn't really matter what approach you take. But it's nearly
and,
there.
And are you now a full-time writer?
I am. So the first novel, I was working full-time and writing the evenings and at the weekends, but I quit my job in March last year. I was working for just a finance company, and I've been writing full-time since then.
So unless anyone's got a burning question that they're absolutely desperate to ask, we have come to the end of our allotted time. So it only leaves for me to say thank you all very much for coming, and thank you to Sanjeev and to Nadika.
Thank you.